The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. A measure to expand and enhance harm reduction services is making its way through the Oregon legislature this session. We first reported on House Bill 2395, the Opioid Harm Reduction Omnibus Bill, at the beginning of February. That bill was approved by the Oregon House and is now in the state Senate. There was a hearing before the Oregon Senate Committee on Healthcare on April 24th. We're going to hear parts of that on today's show. But first, summer is coming, and if you're in Northern Abya, summer means music festival season. The folks at Australia's National Drug and Alcohol Research Center recently hosted a presentation by Dr. Jody Grigg on music festivals, drug use, and harm reduction. Dr. Grigg's a research associate at the National Drug Research Institute at Curtin University in Perth, where she coordinates the Western Australia arm of the Ecstasy and Related Drugs Reporting System, a project she's been involved with since 2010. Dr. Grigg's presentation was entitled Drug Use at Music Festivals, Key Findings and Harm Reduction Recommendations. In it, she summarizes key findings and recommendations from a large doctoral study on drug use at music festivals, covering topics like drug detection dogs, drug checking, drug amnesty bins, on-site medical services, drug use patterns and practices, reasons for using drugs, and adverse experiences. Let's hear a little bit from her presentation.
So the overall aims were to investigate the nature and extent of drug use, including alcohol, associated with festivals, assess policy and practice strategies aimed at reducing the risk of harm, and ultimately develop recommendations aimed at improving strategies. So a pragmatic mixed methods approach was employed, involving three stepped phases. Firstly, pre-survey qualitative interviews with 29 key informants and 20 regular festival goers. Phase two involved an anonymous online survey with a final sample of almost 2,000 festival goers. And phase three involved post-survey qualitative interviews. And thematic analyses of the qualitative data was used to inform, complement, and interpret analyses of the core data, which was collected from the online survey. And the project was structured around four themes. So prevalence patterns and practices, motives or reasons for using drugs, adverse effects and experiences, and the last theme related to interventions. So now I'm going to take you through the findings from each theme and then take you to the priority recommendations. And the eligibility criteria for the online survey was aged at least 16, resided in WA or Victoria for the past 12 months, and attendance at least one festival in the last 12 months. And I should note that this data was collected in 2016 now, which is a clear limitation to consider as I read through this. And I really do hope to repeat the research sometime very soon. Also, most of the findings presented today are going to pertain to the last festival the participant had attended. So the survey was designed so that we could develop a coherent story of the participant's last festival experience. So on to the findings. The first finding is that 62% of respondents reported using an illicit drug at the last festival they attended. The most commonly reported illicit drug was ecstasy, reported by half the sample, followed by cannabis, reported by about a third, ketamine by about a tenth, and then LSD, nitrous oxide, and cocaine. Among respondents who used a drug at their last festival, excluding tobacco, 68% reported using more than one drug, and the median number was three. Over 300 unique drug combinations were identified. So previous studies hadn't delineated festival-specific polydrug use combinations. So that was a gap in the literature that I wanted to address. While significant diversity in polydrug use was identified, about half reported some combination of ecstasy, alcohol, and/or cannabis. Probably no surprise that alcohol was the most common drug in the mix, with 90% of illicit drug users reporting use. But this represents a bit of a shift from earlier rave culture where alcohol wasn't as prominent. And this adding of alcohol to the mix raises concern given evidence about increased toxicity, unpredictability, and masking effects. And I just wanted to quickly flag this 2021 paper, which concluded that alcohol can have a profound negative impact on MDMA-related hypothermia. Probably not a big surprise, but it is worth noting given it's such a normalised behaviour. And key informants also identified polydrug use as one of the most concerning trends. Patterns of use were not homogenous. So this table is summarising a series of multivariable analyses, which I'm going to talk you through a little. So as you can see, significant differences were identified between genders, jurisdictions, festival types, musical preferences, and ages. So while no difference was identified between jurisdictions in terms of overall drug use, Victorians were more likely than West Australians to report certain types of drugs, such as ketamine, cocaine, and methamphetamine, although there has been shifting trends in terms of ketamine use and cocaine in WA since data collection, so that might not be the case anymore. Meanwhile, West Australians were more likely to report pharmaceutical stimulant use, such as dexamphetamine. In terms of gender, with the exception of a small number of drugs, such as pharmaceutical stimulants and benzos, males had higher odds and were at double the odds of using any illicit. Probably unsurprisingly, multi-day festival goers were significantly more likely to report use of most drugs, particularly psychedelics, where they had 13 times greater odds, nitrous oxide, 5 times greater odds, and cannabis, 3 times greater odds. Multi-day festival goers also had higher overall rates of any illicit drug use, about 3 times the odds. And these findings likely reflect differences in the styles of multi-day festivals. For example, transformational festivals synergize well with psychedelics. They're often in regional locations featuring desirable environmental stimuli. The duration allows greater windows of opportunity, and they're more likely to use drugs to manage cycles of ups and downs across the event. And there's also socio-spatial elements related to campsites where there's more sharing and access to drugs. In terms of age, younger respondents were less likely to report using ecstasy and cocaine and had lower overall rates than over 25s. And lastly, those with a preference for EDM as a genre were more likely to report using illicit drugs except cannabis. So overall, I think it's just useful to be aware of these kinds of differences when planning events and resource allocation, because it's not a one-size-fits-all. Some events might really benefit from certain interventions that would be less useful at other events. And there's a huge diversification in the style of music festivals these days. The study also explored 4 out of the 5 key components of the normalisation thesis as outlined by Parker in 2002 and found strong indications that illicit drug use at festivals was normalised in this sample. For example, almost everyone believed illicit drug use was a normal feature of attending festivals and there was high perceived availability. Only 2% thought that it would have been very difficult to obtain illicit drugs inside the last festival. And there was a lot of discussion in the thesis about the normalisation data, if this area interests you. But overall, I think this has implications for the festival policy debate. We often hear this argument that drug checking will condone or normalise illicit drug use. But I think that argument is weakened if illicit drug use is already normalised, as suggested here. I also wanted to emphasise that pre- and post-festival activities represent key points in the day. So as you can see in this figure, in relation to one-day festivals, 44% used an illicit drug before even getting there and over a third used one after leaving. So no contemporary studies at the time had examined pre-post patterns of use, but these rates were much higher than observed in the earlier rave studies, and that may reflect increased preloading practices now in response to heavy drug policing at events. And this is noteworthy because often that earlier drug use in the day can alter the trajectory of the rest of the day. So these are normally the warmer hours, which has implications for hypothermia. It reduces the inhibitions early, which can encourage heavier patterns of use moving forward, and overall may just reflect riskier patterns of use than if people were planning their day without the risk of policing at the gates. And this was just a nice quote from the qualitative data, which illustrated a typical pattern of polydrug use across a day, where it's common for people to focus on stimulant drugs in the day and then depressants after the event. I won't read due to time, but overall, it's just important to consider pre-post activities when targeting interventions. For example, with pill testing, it's not going to be effective on site for those who have already dropped before they've even arrived. And using drugs to manage cycles of ups and downs is also particularly important for multi-day festivals where people are trying to energize themselves in the day, get rest at night, and then repeat. And in my review of deaths, multiple drug toxicity was very common, and there were a variety of different themes that emerged in that review. So if you're interested in learning more about that, I'd suggest checking out the thesis. Another finding I wanted to share related to the quantities of drugs being used. So a median of 3 ecstasy pills was used across a festival day. At multi-day festivals, the amounts consumed daily were similar, but unsurprisingly, total amounts were higher. And interestingly, males and females mostly use comparable amounts of ecstasy. And when looking at pill and cap forms together, 42% use more than 3 and 20% use more than 5. So overall, there were people using pretty large quantities of ecstasy, but of course, we know nothing about the actual purity or dose consumed. And again, this was back in 2016. Risky patterns of drug use were also very common. One concerning finding was half those who used ecstasy reported double dropping at the last festival. So that's simultaneously swallowing 2 pills at the same time. And if you're interested in learning more about that, we published a paper that you can check out. I won't go through all of the risk practices, but as you can see here, about half reported dancing for prolonged periods without taking breaks. 1 in 5 had used illicit drugs and partied the night before. 1 in 5 went 24 hours or longer without sleeping. And 1 in 10 reported using drugs when in a bad mindset. Gender differences were identified. For example, females were more likely to not eat and hydrate properly, whereas males were more likely to double drop and go 24 hours or longer without sleeping. And although risk practices were reported, respondents also reported actively seeking information about drug content and engaging in a variety of other practices they thought would decrease their risk of harm. A median of 6 were reported from this list. For example, 1 in 10 reported using a reagent testing kit, while half those who used ecstasy pills looked on the Pill Reports website. And I think that reagent testing kit percentage would be a lot higher now, given there's been a lot of increased awareness about them. Other noticeable practices included starting with a smaller amount, 26%, taking magnesium for muscle cramps, 10%, and taking 5-HTP in an attempt to mitigate effects of serotonin depletion. Again, gender differences were observed. And some of you might be thinking that several strategies here lack empirical support, like using 5-HTP. And while I agree, this data was still important to collect as it shows enthusiasm for harm reduction and helps identify areas which might need to be targeted with education.
That was Dr. Jody Grigg, a research associate at the National Drug Research Institute at Curtin University in Perth and coordinator of the Western Australia arm of the Ecstasy and Related Drugs Reporting System. She spoke recently on a webinar entitled Drug Use at Music Festivals, Key Findings and Harm Reduction Recommendations that was sponsored by Australia's National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre. The folks at NDARC have a lot of really, really amazing resources on their website, a lot of tremendous resources available, these webinars, other publications that they do. You can find them on the web at ndarc.med.unsw.edu.au, or just look up NDARC, the National Drug and Alcohol Research Center in Australia. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Oregon House Bill 2395A is entitled the Opioid Harm Reduction Omnibus Bill. We first looked at this measure early in the session at the beginning of February. HB 2395 was approved by the House and is now being considered by the Oregon Senate. A hearing on the measure was held April 24th before the Senate Committee on Healthcare. Let's hear a couple of the chief sponsors first. We'll start with Representative Maxine Dexter, MD. She's followed by Representative James Hebe. Now, there was construction ongoing at the state capitol that day, so you will hear a little background noise during the testimony. My apologies, that's not your radio. That's construction at the capitol during the testimony. Again, my apologies, but let's go.
My name is Dr. Maxine Dexter, and I'm honored to be the state representative for House District 33, which includes downtown in Northwest Portland, Linton, and Cathedral Park. I'm grateful for this opportunity today to present to you HB 2395A, the Opioid Harm Reduction Omnibus Bill, and ask for your support. This bill comes to your committee with a unanimous vote out of the House Committee on Behavioral Health and Healthcare, with one member absent, and a bipartisan 48-9 vote on the House floor. To ensure the committee can hear from those who will be directly impacted by the bill, I will keep my comments short, but ask that you refer to my written testimony in OLIS. It is impossible to ignore the profoundly tragic impact that illicitly manufactured fentanyl is having across Oregon. The threat it poses to every member of our community is very real. Our responsibility as elected leaders is to ensure the health and safety of Oregonians. This package is an opportunity to urgently take data-driven action that will start saving lives almost immediately upon passage. I'm deeply grateful to be able to testify to you today in solidarity with a broad coalition of partners who have worked with my team for many months to bring this omnibus package forward that truly centers a harm reduction and public health focused approach. Courageous leaders across many sectors have leaned in and elevated the high importance of this work to get to where we are today, a well-considered bipartisan package that has earned the support of harm reduction advocates, law enforcement, clinicians, students, educators, local governments, and our public health system. Mr. Dietz already outlined much of what the bill does, so I'm going to refrain from going over that, and I'm just going to, again, express my gratitude for the many partners who will be sharing their testimony, as well as public who have been impacted by fentanyl and the dramatic harm that it has done to our community. I will also note that my office has a companion bill in HB 2397 that would establish a fund for OHA to continue their life-saving work with the Clearinghouse Project.
Apologies for the noise. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Heath, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, Vice Chair, and as Senator. I'm here today because I hate drug addiction and what it does to families. I have seen firsthand the impact it can have on families. When I got back from the Marine Corps, I came back and all three of my brothers were addicted to heroin. And I spent about 5 years trying to get my brother into treatment, and I found the treatment system in Oregon is terribly broken. And over the years, well, my grandfather was run over by and killed by somebody high on heroin. My cousin died from an overdose. Two of my brothers died from an overdose. And I have a cousin who's still living on Columbia Boulevard, living out of his car, addicted to these fentanyl pills. And the only time I get to see my cousin, I'll go and drop off Suboxone with him every once in a while and get him a hot meal, trying to encourage him to get clean. But, you know, go back to one instance. 2014, my cousin called me from my brother's phone, and he was like, Joey's foaming at the mouth. He's not doing well. And I told him, call 911, and I drove over there. And by the time I got there and by the time the police got there, he had died. But if he had naloxone on hand, I could have directed my cousin to administer it and potentially have saved my brother's life. And I would not have had to go and tell my mom that Joey died or tell my dad. And a lot of tragedy subsequently came from Joey's death. And so, long story short, this naloxone package, although, like, you know, it will save lives. It's not a magic bullet. It's not going to fix everybody's addiction, but it will give people a second chance at life. And it could have saved my brother. Somebody else is going to be out there, and they're going to be able to save their brother or sister or family member because of this bill. And I urge I vote. So, thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, and our deepest sympathies on the multiple losses that your family has suffered, and thank you for speaking out to help others right now. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If I could quickly, I just want to note for the record that this is Representative Heeb.
If I didn't introduce myself, my name is James Heeb, House District 51, represent Canby all the way to Sandy.
Thank you, sir. And apologies to folks attending and listening. Clearly, there's a lot of work going on under the building. Ask for everyone's patience with that. There's nothing we can do about it. To the extent that you all can speak up, we'll be grateful up here. Thanks.
That was Oregon State Representative James Heeb. He was preceded by State Representative Maxine Dexter, M.D. They're two of the chief sponsors of House Bill 2395, the Opioid Harm Reduction Omnibus Bill, which is currently making its way through the Oregon legislature. Let's hear a couple of the other witnesses. We'll start with Haven Wheelock, Drug Users Health Services Program Coordinator at Outside Inn in Portland, Oregon. She'll be followed by Kayla Kruger with the Associated Students of the University of Oregon.
Chair Peterson, Vice Chair Hayden, members of the committee, I'm Haven Wheelock for the record, and I come to you to support House Bill 2395. I'm not going to go into the overdose crisis. We've heard a lot of that, but from my experience, I've worked in the field of harm reduction, working directly with people using heroin, methamphetamines, and fentanyl for nearly 20 years. And I have to say, I've never seen our overdose crisis like it is right now. I personally have responded to 5 overdoses in the community in the last month and a half, 2 of which were fatal. It doesn't have to look like this. It's been a full 10 years to the day that I sat in front of this committee for our first original naloxone bill. And it's an honor to be here today and to get to support this bill, to get to work with Rep. Dexter and her team on this life-saving intervention. Naloxone is easy to use. It is safe to use. It saves lives. And anything we can do to increase access is going to be helpful. This bill also does a really important stuff around drug checking. Right now, we do have tools that will allow us to identify fentanyl in substances. However, because they are listed as drug paraphernalia, many places are not allowed to distribute these tools. So people are taking drugs, not sure what's in them. These tools are not a perfect tool. They're not a perfect solution. But if you're expecting you're doing something like cocaine or Vicodin and it's actually fentanyl, that could be fatal one time, right? And so these tools are helpful harm reduction tools. This bill also does a lot of really cool and innovative and important public like health approaches, like standardizing death reporting, notification policies. These things from a public health perspective are crucially important in order for us to move forward to save lives, both on the individual level and at the state level.
My name is Kayla Kruger, and I'm voicing my support of House Bill 2395. I've had the privilege of serving on the ASUO Senate for the last 2 years, and in September of 2021, I began a journey. I wanted to allow students on campus, as well as the UO community and beyond, to have access to fentanyl test strips for free. My project was unfortunately rejected due to the state law that prohibits the distribution of testing strips. This was difficult, but it encouraged me to push forward, and I've now regained hope because of House Bill 2395. And I'm urging you, and you already know this, but there's a dire need to provide students with preventative measures to avoid potential overdose. The importance of fentanyl test strips cannot properly be put into words. It's a matter of life and death, controlled by the unknown. Fentanyl is an unseen killer, and drugs can be unknowingly laced with fentanyl, and there is no way of knowing until it is too late. Products like Narcan reduce harm and have saved many lives, yet is more reactionary than preventative. In order to properly administer Narcan, you also need to recognize the symptoms of an opioid overdose and then approach the individual to administer the drug. By providing fentanyl test strips for students and the UO community, there's a chance that that situation could be avoided altogether. The University of Oregon serves a wide population of students, faculty, and community members. By offering fentanyl test strips, we would not only save lives, but also reinforce the importance of drug safety. Further, the UO's influence could reach across the country. We have a large population of out-of-state students, and so by providing this preventative harm reduction methods, we would be able to influence the entire country and save a lot of lives. Each death resulting from a fentanyl overdose is someone's child, someone's friend, a real human being. And most importantly, they should never be treated as a statistic or a cautionary tale. However, their legacy should push us to act. So I urge you to take action and House Bill 2395. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
That was Kayla Kruger with the Associated Students at the University of Oregon. She was preceded by Haven Wheelock from Outside In. They testified April 24th before the Oregon Senate's Committee on Healthcare in support of House Bill 2395A, the Opioid Harm Reduction Omnibus Bill. Let's hear a little more while we have time. Here's Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt.
My name is Mike Schmidt, Multnomah County District Attorney. I'm excited to be here in support of 2395A and like to thank the people who have been doing all the work on this. I submit a testimony. I won't read it, but I'll just say some of the hardest conversations I've had to have as district attorney have been with parents who've lost children inadvertently due to taking fentanyl and maybe not even knowing that that's what they were taking. And one specific conversation, and the point's been made, but it can't be overstated. A mother of a 14-year-old who lost her son and just said, you know, what fentanyl robbed her of was time and an opportunity. And she relayed to me that they knew that he was struggling with substance use, and they were working on that. But fentanyl cut off all of those efforts because he was no longer able to continue in treatment. And making naloxone and these other, the short-acting opioid antagonists widely available for people to be given out is going to save lives and is really important in our community. So I urge your support.
That was Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt testifying before the Oregon Senate's Committee on Healthcare in favor of House Bill 2395A, the Opioid Harm Reduction Omnibus Bill.
My name is Erin Thornton, and I'm an addiction and mental health advocate. I am also a recovering addict. I was not expecting to share my story like this today, but because of some of the questions, I feel it's important. So I started drinking at age 9. By my 13th birthday, I was in a rehab facility. My issue was home was where the drugs were. And the only reason I ended up in rehab was because of an overdose and the state noticing, and it was mandatory. After that, I went home and was surrounded by drugs, you know, so the addiction continued, and my parents were not going to let me go to a rehab facility. They did not want to get in trouble. Like, that's just what it was. My best friend overdosed. He was 13 years old. Another friend living in a similar situation killed himself. He was 13 years old as well. It has gotten worse out there. My story has become so much more common. I don't know. I think it's crucial that we consider the kids living in the families that don't have the proper love and support to get them treatment. I don't see anyone trying to steal someone's kids who's doing their job. You know, I just don't see that as an issue. And I think it's so, we give up so much when we're giving up these lives by not having laws like this. And that's really all I wanted to share.
That was Erin Thornton, a community advocate, testifying before the Oregon Senate's Committee on Healthcare in favor of House Bill 2395A, the Opioid Harm Reduction Omnibus Bill. Well, this is a story that we're following. We'll bring you more news as it develops, so keep tuning in. For now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed
war on drugs. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.